This message was presented at the 2013 Lightbearers Convocation.
Our daughter, Kara, she was quite small. She used to go to her daddy, James, and she'd say, "Daddy, will you please show me your arm?" And, "Sure, I'll show you my arm." Why would Kara be wanting her daddy to show her his arm? Well, James had just started. He'd always been really thin. Some of you guys maybe remember how thin James used to be for a while there. And he started working out. And he started working out in a really big way. And he worked out in such a big way that his arms, my arms I know are so small you're not going to see them. But he would roll up his sleeve. When she'd say, "Daddy, show me your arm," he'd roll up his sleeve like that. And he would go like that. And she'd be like, "Ah." She loved the way it looked. And to be honest with you, I did too. They always say women aren't visual, and I think that's a bunch of baloney. So, "Daddy, show me your arm." She wanted to see him unleash his strength. Show me just how powerful that thing is. Now, it's interesting because the health message has been likened to the right hand or the right arm of the body, hasn't it? And as such, it's supposed to be this intimately connected, kind of an outgrowth of the gospel, connected with tissue and muscle and blood and nerves. And yet somehow the way we have related to it, the way we've treated it, the way we've handled it in our life has been cut off from the gospel. Have you felt the gospel in the health message, or have you felt a bunch of lists of what you're supposed to do and not supposed to do and checklists? And yet it's supposed to be this intimate connection. I find these two verses really beautiful in the context of what we're talking about. Isaiah 52:10 says, "The Lord has made bare his holy arm." The Lord wants to make bare to you and I his holy arm. What he's saying that in the context of Isaiah 52, it's talking about salvation, his power, his incredible power that he extended toward you and I in saving us. But he wants to reveal the power of his arm. Psalms 98:1 says, "His right hand and his holy arm has gotten him the victory." And I just want to encourage you guys this week, as we are here, as you come to this time period with me when we're going to be focusing on the subject of health, that you would see it maybe in the context of God unleashing and revealing, wanting to extend something for you and I that's going to be a means of giving us the victory. And I just pray that it will be a blessing to you. Let's begin with prayer. Father in heaven, we give you this time. I ask that you would send your angels, your spirit, to be here in our midst, and that as we cover what I prepared today, Father, that it would be appealing, that it would be presented in a way that would enter into the hearts and minds and find a peaceful lodging place, a reception, and we just ask for your blessing in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, we're studying the book of Acts this week, as you know, and the book of Acts was lived out in the ancient Roman culture, right? And the ancient Roman culture is very interesting because when you look about it, you realize that food was just a central part of their culture, that the dining room was the most important room in a Roman's house, that it was the most elaborately decorated, and that the dining time was the most important time of the day. Dramatic forms of food presentation began, and I found it interesting as I was reading about how they would cook and prepare their food, that they would take food and not just cook it nicely and prepare it, but that they would try to disguise it to be something that it wasn't. So they would make art scenes with food, and they would make pastoral scenes, and I think the thing that stuck with me the most was because I found it quite interesting, is they'd make these pastoral scenes with trees and bushes and animals and droppings, and the droppings would be dates. Isn't that something? Let me have one of those, you know. So food was just this, an elaborate art. There was also a lot of feasting, and there was a lot of gluttony and excess in the Roman culture that was thrown around food. They would eat, and then they would go purge themselves, and then they would come back and eat again. We've all heard about that. And that was just normal. That was just the way they did things. The food industry has been attracting extra attention of other kinds here in America and around the world. This was written in England, as you'll be able to see. It was written in the magazine The Economist, and it says, "For years, some of the most popular television programs in English-speaking countries have been cooking shows. That may point to a healthy interest in food, but then again, it may not. The historian Livy thought the Roman Empire started to decay when cooks acquired celebrity status. Do our cooks have celebrity status? Yeah, you know, Bobby Flay, Rachel Ray, Kat Coro. I mean, some of these names, I don't see any people recognize. You guys don't watch food shows? Okay, some people don't. Okay, so we have celebrity status for our cooks, but what he's talking about isn't necessarily our kind of celebrity status. In Roman times, cooks had been slaves and servants and just people that did the menial work, cook my food. But when they started bringing in the Asian influence of having many courses and beautiful food, then all of a sudden the cook became elevated in the eyes of the people and valued because of what they were producing. Now, this is interesting. Michael Applebaum asked a question, and it's the question that was kind of seen here. He said the historian Livy thought the Roman Empire started to decay when cooks acquired celebrity status. So something with food and eating somehow contributed to the fall of the Roman Empire. Michael Applebaum's a physician. He's a lawyer. He was asked the question, what caused the fall of the Roman Empire? And he answered, their diet, according to many modern scholars. Now, their diet, interestingly enough, was very tainted. Their water was tainted. Their wine was especially tainted. Their food was tainted with lead. They served it in lead. They prepared it in lead. Lead was used as a flavor enhancement and as a preservative. And so these people were getting poisoned, right? They were undergoing lead poisoning. Water supplying their fresh water led to lead poisoning. Much of the food and wine the Romans consumed to such excess was contaminated with amounts of lead far exceeding today's safety standards. Accumulations of lead in the body can cause one form of gout, a painful and sometimes crippling inflammation of the joints, as well as the mental retardation and erratic behavior normally associated with lead poisoning. Interesting. Here we see that pictures, you know, of opulent feasts and the ruler is usually overweight. Quite so, and everyone's catering to him. The cruel Nero was one of these. He was known for having tremendous feasts that would last from noon until midnight. Then there was the Roman Empire Emperor Vitellius, and Vitellius was known for his gluttony. He would send his armies across the empire to get exotic ingredients. One of his favorite things to have to impress people was flamingo tongue. You know, where did you have to go to get flamingo tongue to serve at your feasts? King Louis XIV was brought in enlightened gluttony into his realm. His sister-in-law saw him eating four bowls full of different kinds of soup, a whole pheasant, a partridge, and that was just the beginning. And she said that he incapacitated himself by eating so much on his wedding day. He incapacitated himself for his wedding night. Couldn't move. He was amazing. There's another caliph, I don't have a picture of him, named Solanan, who died of acute indigestion, but this was an account of what he ate on a pilgrimage to Mecca at a single meal. He ate 70 pomegranates. 7-0. 70 pomegranates, a kid, a goat, right, a whole goat, 6 fowls, and a huge quantity of grapes. This man had a tremendous capacity to put in a lot of food. There we see William the Conqueror, who conquered many battles, but he didn't conquer the Battle of the Bulge. He was very overweight. He actually put himself on a diet in 1087, no food, only alcohol. He died at the age of 59 after his stomach, protruding over the forward part of his saddle as he was riding a horse, hit, and it burst open his internals. King Henry VIII, when he wasn't marrying and divorcing, he was feasting. And he also got to be quite heavy. At 340 pounds, he was too heavy for horseback riding, but he still did it. And at 44, his horse rolled on him in a tournament, crippling one leg and leaving him a chronic invalid. So that impeded his ability to exercise, which didn't help his problem. His eating habits continued. And his last 4 years, he was measured at having a waist circumference of 4.5 feet. And he weighed 400 pounds at the time of his death, which was at age 55. And they've done this by measuring his armor and this kind of thing. Now, Howard Taft was America's largest ruler so far, President Howard Taft. By the end of his first year in the White House, he was tipping the scales at nearly 350 pounds. Tales are told of him consuming 7 plates of food at one time. And I have a list of his menu, but we won't get into all that. He actually lost... The history says that he didn't really enjoy being president, was maybe why he ate away his grief. And when he wasn't nominated for a second term, it was a blessing for him because that's when he decided, I'm going to get in shape. And he lost 80 pounds, and so he had a better end, which is good. Now, in the context of all this, you may be wondering, why are you sharing this with us? I want you to contrast what we just looked at with this Bible verse. Ecclesiastes 10:17 says, blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles. And hopefully not just noble in, you know, who they are, but in noble in character as well. And your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Now, the definition of drunkenness is a state in which a person's normal capacity to act or reason is inhibited. It's inhibited, right? We can actually eat ourselves into this weakened state. And the Bible here is drawing a connection for you and I between how we take care of this body and how it impacts how we live and the way we think and our mind and so forth. Contrast this with the Bible's account of one of the greatest leaders of the Christian empire, of Christianity in this world. It says Saul, who later became Paul, ate after he was baptized, and he was strengthened. No weakening, no drunkenness, no intoxication. This man ate for strength and not for drunkenness. And even though he lived in an era, he was surrounded, his culture was of excess and opulence and luxury. He knew how to eat for strength. And this impacted, I think, the Christian faith and the writing of the Word of God more than you and I probably can put our finger on. We'll be forever thankful that he chose this path. Now, you and I live in a similar culture in many respects. We live in an era of excess, and it's challenging, isn't it? It's very challenging, especially when it comes to weight, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. And I want to begin by telling you, a lot of times when we hear about weight, it's the traditional too many calories, not enough exercise. Too many calories, right? So we want to reduce calories and increase. And we make that as if it's this simple, little, compact, nice definition of what it means when we gain or how to lose weight. But I would like to suggest that your weight is actually the result of a multitude of factors. There's many factors involved in what you and I weigh. It's not just the calories, and we'll be looking at that. Because there's a reason why there's so much defeat. There's a reason why we lose, and it's so easy for us to gain. There's a reason why America is the heaviest nation in the world. So I drive a silver Prius. You may see me bebopping around here in my little Prius. And we're going to use my car as an analogy for weight loss. Let's say that every day I drive for a living, and every day I put in 10 gallons of gas. Now, on a good day, I actually get 50 miles per gallon on my Prius. I have to drive it really carefully and, you know, do this. But I get 50 miles per gallon. So every day I drive 500 miles, I put 10 gallons in, drive 500 miles, I use up what I have, nothing more, nothing less. This is my daily routine, and it works. It's great. I have what's left in the reserve tank, and that's it. And that's how I live. Now, let's say that I do my traditional thing. I put in the 10 gallons of gas, but today I'm only going to drive 450 miles. What's that going to do? I have 1 gallon of gas left over. And in our analogy, that 1 gallon of gas is going to be siphoned out, and it's going to be put in the trunk, in the boot, in the hatch, whatever you want to call it, the thighs, the stomach, the wherever it goes. But we're going to just put, that's our reserve. We didn't use it up that day, so it's our reserve. And we think, no big deal. You know, I do this all the time. Some days I put, you know, I'm going to need it. It's going to even out in the long run. But I do this for a week, okay? And then after that week, I go to a birthday party. Or maybe it's a holiday. And on that particular day, I'm not going to drive quite as far because I want to spend time at this birthday party. I drive 300 miles, but I'm going to cram in 12 gallons of gas on this particular day. So on this day, I'm going to have 4 gallons of gas left over, plus my 7 from last week, which is going to equal 11 extra gallons of gas. Now, that wouldn't be that big of a deal either if I didn't have this habit. And my habit is that every day I drive to the gas station and I put in my 10 gallons of gas. So I've got 10 gallons of gas that I normally put in plus this extra 11. And if this continues, if I create some kind of pattern, I'm going to pretty soon have enough gas in my trunk to drive across America without having to stop except to keep loading up my gas tank with what's in the back, right? it can be very easy to store up extra fuel. We have habits, and it's interesting because we think that most of our lives we're reasoning and making decisions. Nah. Most of our lives, well, 40% of our lives is our habits. They're things that we do automatically, and we can be thankful for that. We'd probably all burn a fuse if we didn't have habits because they make our brains work less. Habits have certain ingredients, and we'll be looking a lot at habits tomorrow. These are the ingredients, though: cues, rewards, routines, and then cravings. Having cravings established is what really fuels habits. Well, here in America, we have a lot of habits, and a lot of them pertain to the way we think and relate to food. As you can see here, this is a global obesity problem. Some of these countries weren't filled in with color to show us where they stand. And as you see here, 0 to 5% obese adults in population, they show that in China and India. And yet I read recently where India is kind of surging in their weight issues as well, because they're parting from their vegetarian ways and this kind of thing. They're now eating the cow rather than worshiping the cow in some locations. So, but here you see that America, 30 to 40%, we are right there up at the top. Not surprising to any of us. Why is that? And I think it's because of the way sometimes we think about food. How do we think about food? It's not just fuel in our minds. Sometimes it's Prozac on a plate, right? It's an antidepressant. And I put that picture there of the girl sitting on the floor by her freezer eating a quart of ice cream because, you know, isn't that the traditional thing that a young girl does when her boyfriend breaks up with her? You got to go to the freezer and grab your quart of ice cream and just sit there because somehow that is going to help you deal with the problem. Valium-like victuals. Valium, anti-stress, anti-anxiety. Anybody ever relate to food that way? Please help me to, you know, de-stress from the situation. And yeah, of course we do. Food is the most widely abused anti-anxiety drug in America, and yet exercise is the most potent, yet underutilized antidepressant. Interesting what we turn to. Oh, Starbucks stimulation. This is really big in America, isn't it? We want to be stimulated. We need that pep for the day. We know where to go to Starbucks. Rations of reward. I love this little picture down here. It says, do not reward yourself with food. You are not a dog. But we do that, don't we? Oh, I accomplished something, and so we're going to drive, and we're going to reward ourselves in this way. This is how we perceive food. When it's time for celebration, it's food. Snacking, it's to soothe me. When it's time for fun, again, it usually centers around food. And to a large degree, I think that's the way it was supposed to be. But there's still a habit pathway going on in our brain that we probably need to look at and think about if we're on a mission to lose weight. Food, no matter what, though, however we look at it, the reality is that food, other than water, is calories. And calories are meant to produce fuel. Fuel for our body. Now, when we eat, we don't just eat carbohydrates, but that's what we're going to focus on today. We eat carbohydrates, protein, fats. Those are the three main categories. But for today's talk, we're going to limit it to carbohydrates, which when we break them down, when we digest it, is broken down to glucose. Glucose enters the bloodstream, and that glucose provides the fuel, right? The gasoline in the tank, that our cells then use that glucose, take that in, and use it to produce energy. Now, when we put in fuel, if there's excess, there's two ways that we store it. And one of the ways that we store excess fuel is glycogen. Any glucose not needed right away gets stored in this way. And here you see that little man. Glucose is in the bloodstream from the food that we eat. And insulin is the guy that makes it possible for that glucose to enter cells, to enter tissue, to enter any organ so that it can be used as fuel to make energy. You can't live without it. So here we see it opening, and it can go into two pathways, a muscle or to be used right then and there. So when we eat, we have a lot of active, immediate energy at our disposal that we can use to move our muscles, to exercise, to act. But if we have excess, then it's going to be stored as glycogen. And this is just a normal pathway. The body doesn't want a lot of glucose in the blood all at one time. That's actually very harmful to us to have too much glucose in the bloodstream at one time. So this is just a natural process of forming it into glycogen. And glycogen is just stored glucose molecules. It packs all those glucose molecules together, and it stores them as potential future energy. Now, how much energy can we store this way? Humans can store approximately 800 to 2,000 calories in the form of muscle glycogen. Now, if you had that much, if you had 2,000 calories of glycogen in your muscles, and you went out and you exercised and you used up a lot of that glycogen, you could go and eat 1,000, 1,500 calories of even a fast-acting carb, and you wouldn't gain a pound because that would be immediately used to replenish the glycogen stores in your muscle and in your liver. So 800 to 2,000 calories we store in the form of muscle glycogen, a small amount of circulating glucose in the blood. We always need glucose in the blood at all times because it's that glucose that fuels our brain. And 250 to 500 calories stored in the liver. And the liver is responsible for keeping the glucose in the blood at an even level. Body likes 80 to 100 level in the blood at all times so that the brain has a continuous supply of fuel to make its energy. So when we wake up in the morning from an overnight fast, only a fourth of the glycogen remains in the liver. So when you sleep, you're not eating. Hopefully you're not eating in the middle of the night because that's going to be very detrimental to weight control. But when you wake up in the morning, you fasted that whole night long, and what's kept you alive and given you energy throughout that whole time is the liver breaking down that glycogen, putting more glucose into your bloodstream so that you stay alive until the next morning. And then breakfast resupplies that. Increased storage. Now, if you increase your storage of glycogen, which we can do, it can double your duration of exhaustive work. In other words, you may only be able to do this much work before exhaustion. You're just like, I can't do anymore. But if you increase your glycogen storage, you can do twice that amount of work before you feel that exhaustion. Lower depleted glycogen stores limits exercise intensity. You can't exercise as hard. Decreases time to exhaustion, increases rating of perceived exhaustion during physical activity. So how can we get more glycogen? We exercise. And as we exercise and as we use up the glycogen, as we build bigger muscles, we increase our storage in that way, and that's how we can do it. Now, the second way we store excess fuel, energy, is fat. Excess fat is stored in lipocytes, which expand in size until the fat is used for fuel. Now, there is, when you look at adipose tissue, when we always think that what we eat, when we eat too much fat, that becomes fat. Right? Do we understand that? If I want to eat a low-fat diet. That used to be the big thing. Eat a low-fat diet, and then you're going to be able to lose weight. But what we don't understand is that you can produce fat from something that isn't fat, and that is carbs. And here we see lipogenesis. Genesis means the creation of, the origin of, the beginning of. Fat, lipo, is the creation of fat from something that isn't fat. Lipolysis, on the other hand, is the breaking down of fat and using it as energy. And our body is constantly going through both of these two different cycles between the two. Now, the lipogenesis is the process by which excess fuel is converted into fatty acids. So what happens with that excess glucose in the bloodstream? We talked about that it can either be stored in the liver or used up in the muscles, but it can also now be converted into fat. That excess glucose now goes through this transformation where it can be stored as fatty acids. Now here we see this guy who is exercising. He's increasing his ability to store glycogen, and so the excess food that he's eating, most of it's going to this, dedicated to his muscles and to producing energy. Whereas the other guy who maybe isn't exercising except for his arm as he's eating there, he's more likely to store that excess as fat. Here again is another picture just illustrating that excess blood glucose being converted into fat. And adipose tissue. So we have adipose tissue that's external, that's just beneath the skin. And then we have the adipose tissue that's internal, that's called visceral, and it's packed around the organs. And that's the stuff that is the most dangerous, because a lot of times we look at fat as these blobs that just hang out there and they have no activity, but they're actually very active metabolically. They actually produce hormones. They actually direct and govern a lot of the body's activities, which also makes it even more difficult for us to lose weight. Now, the fat that we make from excess fuel is called DNL fat. Don't ask me what the DNL, because it doesn't really matter what it stands for, but it's just DNL fat. That's what they've called it. It is increasingly clear that fatty acids and their derivatives are important signaling molecules that affect many fundamental physiologic processes. It's telling us that these things direct, they command, they have things happen. DNL has bioactivities distinct from those of fatty acids from the diet. In other words, the fat that you and I make from excess carbs behaves differently. It does different things inside of the body than the fat that we consume. Therefore, there is growing interest in the physiological role of DNL in normal biology and in disease states such as obesity, type 2 diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. So they're saying DNL fat is even more dangerous than just the fat that we eat, than... And I think that it's important to realize that low fat, you know, we were talking about low fat and all these no fat, you see packages of snacks that say no fat. Those are actually probably more harmful for us and detrimental. You're not going to lose weight that way, because even though it's probably going to be high carb, so you're putting in a lot of sugar, a lot of glucose into that bloodstream, and because it's that excess glucose, the body says we got to bring that down, and it's going to then convert it and produce this DNL fat. DNL fat has been found to elevate serum triglycerides, increases intrahepatic lipids, it's talking about fatty liver, strongly correlates with insulin resistance, enhances production of pro-inflammatory substances, just to let you know how active it is. Now, the thing with using up our excess is that we have to use what's in the tank before we can use what's stored in the trunk. And who here likes to run on empty? I do it all the time on my car. I'm always running on empty, and I'm always like, oh, how am I going to make it? I didn't realize, because my little Prius, it doesn't beep, 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 beep when it, you know, it beep, beep, beeps when I'm backing up. It beep, beep, beeps if no one's, if the seatbelt's not in, but if I don't have gas, it's just this little tiny thing that just blinks once. And that's my sign and signal that I need to go to the gas tank. Plus, I really like to get good gas mileage on it, so I'm always competing with myself. Let's see, how long can I drive it on this amount of gas? So it's kind of ridiculous, I know, but we don't like driving on empty, and physiologically, we just don't like that feeling. I like it when I have a full tank, when I know I have, you know, something to count on for energy. I hate that feeling of being absolutely starving, but that is the issue that has to be dealt with. It takes a whole lot more effort to get out of the car, pick up those heavy, stinky gas containers, and put them in, and here in Oregon, for those of you who live here, and maybe for those of you who are visiting, you'll realize it's so easy to get retanked up. You just drive to the nearest gas station, hand someone your card. You don't have to get out of the car. They pump it for you, give you your card back, and off you go. Your hands haven't gotten stinky. You haven't nothing. It's just so easy, and that's the way it is with food as well. Now, we've probably heard of the body mass index. And the body mass index is a way for us to know, okay, where do I stand in terms of, you know, do I need to lose weight? How much fat do I have? And that kind of thing. So here you see this graph, and it's kind of hard to read because of the lighting and because it's so small here. But here it says, for example, a 5'11" individual who weighs 180 pounds is overweight. Here's someone who's 5'7", who weighs 150 pounds, they're a normal weight. And you could see, if you could plot yourself on there, whether you were in the normal weight, the overweight, or the obese, or the extreme obese. And here it says underweight is BMI under 18.5, normal weight 18.5 to 25, overweight 25 to 30, and obese is 30 to 39.9 to 40. But they've said, you know, this isn't really that accurate of a way of determining how much, you know, my state of health. See that picture, the cartoon there, is supposed to give us an idea. The 18.5, that guy's pretty slender. He's a little underweight, isn't he? Then the other guy looks good. He looks robust. He looks ideal weight. Then we have the overweight guy, 23 to 27.5. These are a little different in terms of their numberings. And then obese, greater than 27.5, whereas on that chart it said 30. But then you look at these actual individuals. Here we have an athlete at 17.6, and I'd say she looked really healthy. She looks like she's doing pretty good. Then we have Governor Huckabee, and he's doing pretty good too. He would be considered overweight, but he looks like he's doing really in shape. Then the little foo-foo model there who's sticking her fingers up, everyone would say like, oh, she's the norm. She's what we want to look like. She's grossly underweight. Do you know that runway models in Milan and in Madrid, that the agencies who, you know, hire models to do all their modeling on the runway strips, they refused 5 models because their BMI was under 18.5, and I thought it's about time. It's about time we start doing that. Those models are grossly underweight, and yet we think that that's the norm. But then you look at Sylvester Stallone. Would you say he was obese? No, you would say that is a hunk of a man, right? Well, I would. Okay, so his BMI is 30.1, and you would say, oh, that's, you know, why, he's really obese. No, that guy is really muscular, right? So you have to realize, and then you can also say, wow, someone who has a BMI that's maybe 20, but maybe they just never exercise, and they actually have a lot more fat than they do muscle. You can't tell by, you know, everything by the BMI. The key is, and I'm not a person that likes to always be comparing myself to numbers and, you know, exact and make that define who I am. But the key is that you'd be developing more muscle, and as a result, you'd be expending more of that fat. So that's the BMI. I have this slide here because what do you think has, what nation in the world do you think has the largest BMI? U.S. This slide is a key. Can you read what it says there? No, of course not, because it's in Kuwait. They actually have the largest BMI in the world. It's very interesting. But, you know, the money's there. They have the ability to provide for themselves, and they do so. Okay, so I put this in here as a little brain relaxer for a moment because I thought it was interesting that if we were to weigh all the ants in the world and we were to weigh all the humans in the world, which do you think would be heavier? The ants would be heavier. You guys already know this. Okay, I thought that was like, wow. The ants would be heavier. There are a lot of ants. And I don't think ants are having an obese problem like humans are, but there's a ton of ants in the world. Okay, back to science. All right, there are some hormones that we need to deal with if we're thinking about weight loss. And one big one is insulin. Insulin rises in response to glucose. And we talked about insulin's what takes that is it detects, oh, we've got too much glucose going on in the blood. We're going to take that glucose, it needs to come out of the blood, and we're going to package it, right? We're going to take it, and it's either going to be go into the muscles and be used as energy to make ATP or ATP lookalikes, or else it's going to go into the liver where it's going to be stored as glycogen, and that glycogen in the liver is then going to resupply the bloodstream as it needs it, or it's going to be stored in the muscles as glycogen as well, and that can be used later as fuel, or it's going to become fat, right? That's the job of insulin. So here we see a normal, healthy person, their blood glucose levels just kind of gradually rising with meals because the insulin is available to take care of that excess blood sugar. Insulin spikes at that time, and then it lowers. Now, it's very interesting that when insulin levels drop because blood sugar is dropping, that is the trigger. Low insulin levels are the trigger for the body to say, okay, we need to use another source of energy. Let's go use glycogen. Let's go use fat. If insulin levels stay high, the body's going to say, we don't need to mess with any of that stored stuff. Let it stay right there. We've got plenty of available fuel, and it's easy and it's efficient. The guy at the gas tank just keeps filling me up. We don't need to, you know, get out of the car and use the stuff in the back of the hatch. So insulin is a marker, and it's going to help us with understanding why certain things work with weight and control and certain things don't. So lipolysis is the breaking down of fat, remember. Instead of storing more, we want to know how we can break fat down to use it as combustible matter. And that's low insulin, and it's elevated stress hormones. Now, we always think, oh, that's not good. Elevated stress hormones mean I have to be stressed out all the time. No, it just means that you have to maybe be fasting for a little bit of time, or it means that you have to be exercising for those stress hormones to be elevated just a little bit, so that again the body says, oh, I need fuel. I'm going to go tap into those stored areas where I have excess fuel stored. Here's another graph that I thought would make it easier to understand. Insulin-stimulated fat formation. We're eating, insulin's rising, blood glucose is rising, so we're storing the stuff as fat, we're storing it. But then when we're not eating, when insulin levels have dropped, then we have fat loss due to reduced insulin. We have that lipolysis, the breaking down of that fat, and using that fat as energy. Ways we can jeopardize using extra fuel. We can drive shorter distances. We always think, put less fuel in the tank, drive shorter distances, that's my way. But the body doesn't usually adapt to this very long. Remember, I'm used to driving a certain amount. I'm used to putting a certain amount of fuel in my tank, and I end up driving more slowly. And when I drive more slowly in my Prius, guess what kind of gas mileage I get? I'm going to pretty soon be getting 56 miles to the gallon. I'm only driving a shorter distance, but I'm pushing it. And that's what happens sometimes in our body, that we can do in our body. We become even more efficient at using the less calories that we put in. We can use the wrong kind of fuel. That can also be very detrimental to us and end up with those spikes in blood sugar. And then we end up, even though it's less calories, we have spikes in blood sugar, and those spikes in blood sugar, that excess sugar is going to be what? Used and transported, stored back into fat. So that's going to be counterproductive. Then we keep putting fuel in intermittently. I keep stopping at the gas station instead of using up what's in the back. Snacking every 2 to 3 hours after a meal, what ends up happening is that my insulin never drops. And if my insulin doesn't drop, guess what's going to happen? Or guess what's not going to happen? I'm not going to use my stuff that's stored. That fat is going to stay fat, and it's not going to get broken down and put into the bloodstream and used as energy. Now, when we think of fasting, we think, okay, fasting, that's the time I'm going to raise my stress hormones, and I'm going to give my body a time to break down fat and use that as energy. And so I'm going to fast, and I'm all that night I'm going to be fasting, going to be losing weight then or breaking up fat. And I'm not going to eat breakfast because that extends the fast even longer. Well, that has been found to be counterproductive as well. People skip breakfast thinking they're cutting calories, but by mid-morning and lunch, that person is starved, says Milton Stokes, who's a RD, MPH, chief dietitian at St. Barnabas Hospital. Breakfast skippers replace calories during the day with mindless nibbling, binging at lunch and dinner, and they set themselves up for failure. So, have you heard of the Successful Weight Loss Maintenance National Weight Control Registry? This is an establishment in which they have found who in America has lost weight and kept it off successfully for an extended period of time. Because our statistics here aren't that great. Some 90% of people rebound, they lose and they regain, and they lose and they regain. And so this yo-yo dieting thing isn't good for us either. So they said, what is the secret of success? What are these people doing? So here were some of the behaviors, and they have thousands of people logged, and they have to have lost over 30 or 50 pounds, and they have had to have kept it off for a certain amount of time. So here we have high levels of physical activity. So we have an hour a day. Low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet. Interesting. I thought it was supposed to be the no-carbohydrate, high-protein diet that made us successful in losing weight. You would think almost, huh? When you realize how insulin affects us and can be detrimental, and yet these people ate high carbohydrates, and it was probably the kind of carbohydrates that they ate. Rather than causing these tremendous fluxes of blood sugar, which the body said, we don't like that high blood sugar, store it, right? They caused probably more gradual blood sugar rises, so the body didn't feel like it had to store that so much, releasing the energy gradually rather than too quickly. Regular self-monitoring of weight and food intake, and voila, eating breakfast regularly. Now, I want to tell you about this substance called carnitine because I thought it was so interesting. And this is not to be confused with creatine. Creatine is what a lot of weightlifters take. It's, you know, to provide, help them make more ATP and have more energy. This carnitine is actually very important in the process of fat being used as energy, and that's what we want to happen. We want to take that fat, break it up, and not let it be go back to fat storage, but actually combust it and have it used as energy. So here we have someone ate a steak, they got fat from it, was turned into fatty acids, and then in the organ, in the cell, it wants to go, in order to be burned up as fuel, in order to make energy, it has to enter into this little part within the cell called the mitochondria. And in the mitochondria, that's where it's going to get burned up and make energy. Now, in order for that fat to enter into the mitochondria, it needs a shuttle bus. It can't just go in by itself. And carnitine happens to be that shuttle bus. It's a transporter of fat into cells, and it's absolutely essential in this process of fatty acids being used, of fat being used as a fuel source. And as it being thrown, if you can picture it, just being thrown into the furnace and burned up as fuel, and that's what we want to do with all of our fat. Well, the body makes carnitine. It makes carnitine from amino acids, but there are many situations in which our bodies may not be producing enough. And one of those situations happens to be if you're trying to diet. If you're trying to diet, if you're trying to burn up a lot of that fat, you're exercising and you're maybe fasting and you've tried to, you know, put in the keys, you might need extra carnitine to make sure that all the fatty acids that are in your bloodstream enter into the cells and get shoveled into the furnace. If you don't have enough carnitine, it's not going to work. Carnitine supports the normalization of blood lipids. These are fats in the blood. We get our blood results back. We see triglycerides, and we see HDL cholesterol, and we see lipoproteins, and we know that high levels of certain of these are bad for the heart. Too much fat in the blood is bad. It's not good for us. Just like too much sugar in the blood isn't good for us. How do we get it out of there? We got to use it as fuel, and this carnitine is really important, as we'll see. Serum lipid concentrations were determined in patients treated with 900 milligrams a day of carnitine. Serum triglyceride was significantly reduced and concentrations continued to decline as carnitine administration continued. Serum, we're talking about the blood, triglycerides going down in the blood as a result of being supplemented with carnitine. One study found L-carnitine to lower triglycerides by 28%, total cholesterol by 12%, while raising HDL by 12%. And this was carnitine alone. This wasn't like with a diet or with something else. L-carnitine, 2 grams a day, significantly reduced lipoprotein levels, the reduction being more dramatic in the subjects with more marked elevations. In a significant number of subjects, the reduction of lipoprotein resulted in a return of this major cardiovascular risk parameter to a normal range. What are all these big words saying? They're just saying that carnitine is going to help make your blood values of fat, different forms of fat, with triglycerides, lipoproteins, whatever ones it was talking about, it's going to help return them to a normal level because it's taking them and shuttling them into the furnace. Fat burning is intensified during endurance exercise, and L-carnitine was shown to increase the efficiency of this process. So you're trying to burn that fat, you're going for the exercise, and you're like, man, I'm trying so hard. What is it that might be keeping me from getting past the edge? It might be something like this. And I would encourage people to find their doctor, find a dietitian who can help them know just how to take carnitine. Carnitine transports toxic compounds generated out of mitochondria. It decreases muscle fatigue and brain fatigue. They found this even with mental workers that take L-carnitine. It's shuttling more energy into the brain cells. It has an antidepressant effect, and it facilitates energy production. Okay, so we talked about this. We're going to look at exercise now in relation to when we exercise. We have 3 sources of fuel. Can you guys tell me what they are? The glucose in the blood, right? We've eaten. What else? Fat, right? That's the one we want. And then the other one is glycogen, the stored stuff in the glycogen storage. So those are our 3 sources of fuel that we have to tap from when we're doing any activity, especially exercise. Now, exercise, especially when it's intense at first, it's going to use up a lot of glycogen. Here, this is interesting. Myth, truth. The body completely shuts off one fuel source when it turns on the other. So that's a myth. And we used to think, well, you have to exercise in exactly a certain way in order for you to be able to burn up fat. Otherwise, you're just burning up glycogen, and that's not going to help you with your fat stores. So now they're saying, no, that's a myth. It doesn't just do one or the other. The truth is, what has often been misunderstood by both exercisers and exercise instructors alike is that the body relies on both fat and carbs for energy all the time, albeit in different ratios. So sometimes it's going to use more of that glucose that's come down from glycogen, and sometimes it's going to use more percentage-wise of fat. When you lift heavy weights or undergo intense exercise, you need fast, immediate energy. You've seen those guys, and they lift up. Ugh! Where does all that immediate energy come from? It's from glycogen. They have some tremendous glycogen stores, and it's broken down immediately and used to fuel this. Glycogen is the fuel. Now, have you ever met people and you're like, man, they're so skinny and yet they can eat like a horse? Yeah? What's going on there? If they knew, their body could talk, they'd be like, all that food is just going to glycogen. I'm using up all those tremendous glycogen stores. I'm able to pack all those calories, and it gets shuttled into all my muscles because I've been using them and building strong muscles, and it gets shuttled into my liver, and wow, eat like a horse, and yet they don't gain weight, right? That's what can happen because people say, oh, I better not lift weights. That's not going to help me lose. It will in the long run. It's going to be a safeguard in the long run from regaining your weight back. The body will replace used up glycogen. That means less glucose going towards fat production. Also, increasing muscle mass, the greater the glycogen storage, the greater the potential needs. So you're going to maybe feel hungry, but you know where it's going to be going, back into glycogen storage. Muscle will adapt to hold double and even triple the amounts of glycogen it can store. That's really amazing, isn't it? Here's a myth of the fat-burning zone, and I don't know how well you can see this, but this is a pretty important slide. So here on scenario one, on the pink side, it says that here's this person who's 20-minute walk at 3 miles per hour. Now, the myth used to be was that in order to use fat, you just need to do slow, steady, long-time exercise. So here's someone doing kind of slow, steady. The results was that 67% of the energy that they were burning came from fat. 33% of the energy came from carbohydrates. They were burning 4.8 calories per minute, 3.2 calories from fat and 1.6 calories from carbohydrate. Then you look in scenario two, and they were exercising for 20 minutes, but they doubled the speed. So now they're doing it a bit more robustly, intensely, and their results were that 46% of the energy came from fat. That dropped, didn't it, from scenario one? In scenario one, you're walking slower, but you're burning 67% of the calories from fat. Well, let's keep going. 54% of the energy came from carbohydrates, but we're burning 9.75 calories per minute. That's almost twice as much as scenario one. So the total calories burned from fat when he's jogging is 90 calories, whereas when they were walking, it was 64 calories. So not only is there immediate effects, but then there's long-term effects. What are you burning 3 hours after you exercise? Your body's still, you know, trying to replenish. It's still working. What are you burning 24 hours after you exercise? So they're saying that the best way to exercise is actually doing interval training, and we'll get to that in our slides. So making energy, this is the point that we want to understand, is as we exercise, the more you exercise, the more energetic you're going to feel, the more energy you're producing, the more energy you're storing. It's just this one beautiful cycle that God made within us. And when we feel too tired to exercise, it's probably because we don't have enough glycogen, and we better start increasing the size of the suitcase in order to pack more energy in there. I thought this was kind of funny. This guy, I don't lift weights because I'm injury prone, have back problems, have poor flexibility, and I'm afraid. But I'm injury prone and I have back problems and I have poor flexibility and I'm afraid because I don't lose weight. So it becomes a vicious cycle, doesn't it? So if any of you have those excuses, you might want to interject somewhere and step out and pick some up because it's going to really benefit you. A group of ladies on a multi-week weight loss program, same diet, same amount of exercise, some lost, others didn't. Women who hadn't lost weight did the same total hours of exercise. Don't you hate that? Here I have a friend and we're doing the exact same thing. We're exercising. What's going on? But in a number of shorter periods of time. So there was a difference. They're exercising the same amount, But they're breaking it up into shorter periods. Women who lost weight got daily exercise in one long session. They had lost weight by doing long periods of exercise, which forced their body to switch over to a greater percentage of fat burning. So does that make sense? Not that doing short isn't good, because it is, but if you really are looking for results in weight loss, then try to find a chunk of time and when you can do it. Drive long distances. Oh, they were driving long distances between fuel stops. So instead of short periods of exercise, and then we have maybe a meal, and then another period of exercise, and then we have another meal, and you're actually giving yourself fuel that's going to provide for this, they're just taking a lot longer between it. So they're not stopping to get fuel. They're just exercising and using up their extra storage. We kind of talked about that. Fat oxidation during exercise tends to be higher in low-intensity treatments, but post-exercise fat oxidation tends to be higher in high-intensity treatments. So this is why they're saying the best kind of exercise for us, not only to get in shape cardiovascularly, but also if you're wanting to lose weight or if you're concerned about weight control, is through this high-intensity interval training. Now, this is the research strongly favors this for both fat loss and lean muscle gain maintenance. They've observed the effect of 20 weeks of this interval training endurance on young adults. And when energy expenditure between groups was corrected, this interval training group showed a whopping 9 times the fat loss as the endurance training group. What's endurance training? I'm just going to run, and I'm going to run for miles, and I'm running for miles, and I'm just, wow. Aren't those people amazing? You see people out there riding their bike at this steady pace, but they're just going for a long ways. That's endurance training. That's good. But high-intensity interval training is maybe walking for 3 minutes, and then for the next 30 seconds, just putting it all out. And then walking, you know, another 3 minutes, and then again, putting it all out. So that you're going back and forth between low-intensity, high-intensity, low-intensity, high-intensity. And you can do that with whatever, whether it's biking or walking or jogging, that this is actually much more effective. How you drive. Okay, good. I'm close to the end. I started getting worried when I looked at the clock. So if you wanted to burn up the most gas in your car, how would you drive? You would give your car to my son. In my Prius, you know, I have this little thing, and it says how much my average miles per gallon is. And when that gets up there, I'm just like, James, I got this today or this week. I'm going, you know what I mean? I'm weird. But I give it to my son. My son's going to get in the car, and all of a sudden, we're ripping out of the driveway, and we're stopping, and then we're starting again. And I'm like, no, that's not how you drive a Prius. Have you guys ever been behind a Prius at a stop sign? There was a time when I didn't have one, obviously, and I'd be behind a Prius, and I was like, oh, my goodness, these guys don't know how to accelerate, right? They got a stop sign, and it's green, hello, and they're just barely going across the... That's how you drive a Prius if you want to get good gas mileage, but if you give it to my son, that's not going to happen. You're going to go somewhere. So you're going to be stopped, and then all of a sudden, boom, you're going, right? 0 to 60 in however short a period of time you can, and then you're going to be tearing around, and that's how you're going to drive. So in your life, you need to think about this. If I want to burn up the most gas, how am I going to drive this car? Am I going to just be sitting there, or am I going to get up? And am I going to get up with energy? And am I going to put my will into it? And am I, you know, the attitude and everything? And putting all this information together is going to be helpful as well. And there's a part two tomorrow, so I hope you guys will come for that. I want to close by sharing with you this man's testimony, which I think is really powerful. Millions of Americans are addicted to food, right? And this man was. His name was Duncan Ryan. He was 42. And after getting married, he became a father. He started gaining 20 pounds a year. And five-year-olds at Walmart commented on his size. He had a size 6X t-shirt, barely covered his gut, as you can see there. He said that he went on a cruise with his wife, Kristen, and he could barely wedge himself into the cabin. He spent most of the trip at the buffet. And in the shower, he said he was literally touching all sides. So he said it was out of control, and so was his health. Ryan's sleep apnea was so bad it woke him up every 20 minutes. I was exhausted all the time, even though I wasn't doing anything. In January 2009, chest pains landed Ryan in the hospital. He was suffering from double pneumonia, and the nurses struggled to find a strong enough bed for him. Doctors said that if he would lose 150 pounds, then gastric bypass might be an option. And his wife told him, if you can lose 150 pounds, you can lose all of it. So he weighed 508 pounds. But a lot had to change for him, and he started with his diet. Grudgingly, he joined Weight Watchers. He said goodbye to his twice-a-day McDonald's habit. He had bags of candy stashed around the house, and he got rid of those. And next, he joined the local YMCA. But he was winded just walking to the building. Can you imagine? You're walking to the gym, and you're exhausted when you get there. At first, he could do only 2 minutes of slow walking. How many minutes?
Two.
Don't give yourself too many excuses. This guy had all the excuses. At 2 minutes, he was exhausted. He had to sit down. The next day, I did 4 minutes. And the next thing you know, I was running. By the end of the year, Ryan was down to 188 pounds. A remarkable transformation in such a short amount of time, but he still wasn't happy with his results. I didn't think I looked good. I was gaunt and soft. The epiphany is what led Ryan to the world of weight training. Everything finally clicked for me, he says. The former fat man adjusted his diet to support his new workouts and began packing on 30 pounds of pure muscle. Today, at 215 pounds, he takes great pride in the fact that he looks as good as he feels. Despite all his hard work, Ryan says the change is really all thanks to his wife. She's fantastic, he said. I could never have done it without her. For her part, Kristen says she didn't have a choice. It was a matter of sticking by him, she said. He's the man I love, and it was the right thing to do. And it was worth it. Wasn't it worth it for her? Absolutely. Hang in there, ladies. So, what do you think destroyed Rome? This is what I think. I think ultimately what destroyed Rome, what destroyed the Garden of Eden, what's going to cause many self-destruct is when we start feeding self. And I want you to think of this on a deeper level, I guess. When our focus is on feeding self rather than feeding others, rather than feeding hungry. When the rulers became so focused on self and taking everything in from self rather than doing what was good for the people and good for the government, and that this was what actually destroyed Rome. God wants to change your relationship with food by changing your relationship with Him. And I hope that we'll experience that. Thank you for your time.
This message was presented at the 2013 Lightbearers Convocation. The mission and passion of Lightbearers is publishing, training, and evangelism. To donate or to learn how you can partner with Lightbearers, visit us online at lightbearers.org. You can also call us at 1-877-585-1111. If you prefer, you can write to us at Lightbearers, 37457 Jasper Lowell Road, Jasper, Oregon, 97438. It's through your prayers and generosity that we are able to do what we do. Thank you for listening.